Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to today's Parliamentary Library Lecture. I think most of you know me, but my name's Jonathan Curtis. I'm the Assistant Secretary Research Branch. The lecture series here bring distinguished speakers to the library to speak on significant topics of interest to senators and members and the work of the Parliament. In that context, the issue of Section 44 of the Constitution requires little introduction just at the moment. Its different elements relating to foreign citizenship, office of profit under the Crown and bankruptcy have dominated the headlines for several months. So we thought it was timely to hear from one of Australia's leading constitutional law experts, Professor Anne Toomey. Anne brings diverse experience to her role, covering private sector, parliament, executive branch and academia. She practiced as a solicitor and has worked for the High Court of Australia as a senior research officer. She worked at the Cabinet Office of New South Wales and here in the Parliament as both Secretary to the Senate Legal and Constitutional Committee, which I did as well at one stage, and in this very library as a legal researcher in the legal section. It's great to have her back, albeit briefly. We may not let you go, but Anne will speak. Anne will speak for around 30 minutes, I think, thereabouts. Then she's happy to take some questions, I should think, at the end. So please join me in welcoming Anne Toomey.
Thank you very much. Coming through this building today, you get a strong sense of deja vu from when you worked here before. And one of the things I noticed just coming into this room and hearing the very loudly clicking, ticking clock up there did remind me actually of a Section 44 experience from when I was working here. Two Section 44 experiences actually. The first was Sykes and Cleary occurred when I was recently started here, and I remember in the days before smartphones or even common use of the internet, going down to the High Court to actually get the judgment and then running up the hill as fast as I could and telling everybody in the building, because everybody was profoundly shocked by the Sykes and Cleary case. It really was a huge surprise at the time that Section 44 had that application. And then, as many of you will know in working in the Parliamentary Library, most of the time it was fantastically interesting and you come to work every day full of enthusiasm because you never knew what was going to happen and it was full of adrenaline. But the worst time to work here was during an election campaign, because as soon as everybody went off to their electorates in an election campaign, suddenly all the work stopped. It was terribly, terribly dull. And I remember that happening and sitting there thinking, what can I possibly write about? And I thought, well, you know, maybe I should write about Section 44.5 of the Constitution, because it's the one about pecuniary interests with an agreement with the public service. No one's ever much written about it, not much known about it. Maybe I should write something on that. And I remember sitting at my desk, because it's not the most interesting section of the Constitution, trying to assiduously write something on this, and that clock ticking really loudly. And, you know, it's the only time in my life where I've ever been at work and I'd look up at the clock and I'd discover it was only 4 minutes after the last time I looked at the clock. And then sometimes it seemed to have gone backwards. So not really. My memories of Section 44.5 of the Constitution here are not happy ones. And I remember also sitting here hoping that someone would tear down someone else's electoral poster from a poll and I'd be desperately asked for advice on whether that was a criminal offence, which indeed did happen, and then I happily got back to other work and left Section 44.5 behind. So they were my library experiences of Section 44. They weren't as exciting as no doubt the experiences here have recently been. So as you all know, in 2017 has been a bumper year for Section 44 of the Constitution. We have lost 9 senators so far. I can name them if you really need me to, but I think you will know. Along with 1 disqualified wannabe senator, and 2 representatives have also been forced to by-elections, being Barnaby Joyce and John Alexander. We've had 3 High Court judgments so far and another on the way in relation to Section 44, and a 4th one yet to be heard in December. That's the Allan Gillespie case. The High Court has addressed 4 out of 5 of the aspects of Section 44 of the Constitution. So 44.1, foreign allegiance, 44.2, conviction, 44.4, office of profit under the Crown, 44.5, pecuniary interest in an agreement with the public service. The only one we've missed out on is bankruptcy, And that's been lurking behind the scenes anyway as an encouragement for people to jump. We have learnt quite a lot about Section 44 in the last year, but as you know, there is a lot yet to learn. There is still a lot of uncertainty about it, and the merry-go-round has not stopped yet. I think the most difficult issue about Section 44 of the Constitution is the timing problem. So this revolves around the fact that the Constitution refers to a person as being incapable of being chosen, as well as incapable of sitting if they're disqualified. Now, that reference to chosen was an innovation in the writing of the Constitution. All the bits that they plagiarised from Canada and the United Kingdom and other places, none of them had that word in there. All the previous experience had been disqualification from being able to be a Member of Parliament once you already were one. And there wasn't actually a provision concerning whether or not you were chosen. So it's always been a bit unclear as to what that meant. And one of the most shocking aspects of Sykes and Cleary, when I frantically ran up the hill with the judgment to tell people about it, was that the High Court decided that the point at which you were chosen was not election day, was not the declaration of the poll, was not the return of the writs, but in fact was an entire period going all the way back to the date of nomination. Okay, nobody had any idea that that was a possibility prior to Sykes and Cleary. But that choice by the High Court to classify chosen by reference to an entire period rather than one day has caused massive conceptual and temporal problems, which I'm going to briefly explore now. So what happens if during that period, which is a period of some time, as we'll see, can expand for a lot longer, what happens if during that period a disqualifying event occurs but is also removed? So you were simultaneously disqualified and then had your disqualification removed during the course of that period. Does that mean then you're still disqualified for the purposes of the Constitution? For example, what if a person is convicted of an offence during that period, which would trigger Section 44(2), but the conviction is later quashed and that happens all within the election period? Is it enough that the candidate has become disqualified at any time during this period, or does it not matter if the disqualification has also been removed during that period? The High Court nodded obliquely to this during the earlier case of Ree Callaghan, where four justices pointed out that there was no question as to the temporal operation of Section 44 arose in that case. They said this was because Rodney Callaghan's conviction occurred before nomination and persisted during the whole of the period of time from nomination to the time of the writs for the election were returned. As the later annulment of his conviction was not regarded as being retrospective in nature, it was only regarded as prospective, he was clearly incapable of being chosen for the entirety of the election period. So it wasn't a problem. The problem, however, becomes more acute if an election fails to be completed because a disqualified person is declared elected. According to earlier precedents, and this is now contested in the Holly Hughes thing, and we haven't got the High Court's judgment about that yet, but according to the earlier precedents, an election fails if a person is disqualified, ergo the election period continues until such time as there's been a recount and that seat has been filled. Now, that means the election period can go for quite a long time, potentially for years. This potentially raised a temporal paradox in relation to Rodney Callaghan. The fact of his disqualification meant that the period of election was extended so that the annulment of his conviction technically actually occurred during that election period, because his disqualification had caused the election period to be elongated. So you can see this is a sort of a Doctor Who time-travelling type problem, okay? You can see the difficulties in it, but technically the very fact that you were disqualified by increasing the length of the election period potentially means it gives you the extra time to have your disqualification removed, and therefore you could end up being qualified and elected simply because you were disqualified, which is a rather bizarre interestingly, not even Rodney Carlton was going to run that argument. Either that or he just didn't think of it, which is another possibility. Another example of this problem arose in the case of Holly Hughes. The disqualification of Fiona Nash as a senator would have led on a recount to the election of Hughes. However, in the understandable belief that she hadn't been elected, Ms. Hughes later took up an office of profit under the Crown, being a position with the AAT. Now, two issues arose in relation to that. The first was whether she resigned that position with the AAT before the time of the recount. So unlike Cullerton, we've got a clear case here of someone who was disqualified after the election had been held and the writs had been removed, was then disqualified by taking up an office of profit under the Crown, removed that office of profit under the Crown before the recount was held. Okay, so again, time travelling, it's all quite difficult. So in that particular case, the High Court held that she was disqualified, and in doing so, it's likely it didn't accept the argument that being disqualified and then removing your disqualification during that period is enough to get rid of your disqualification altogether. That's likely what the High Court has decided. We don't know yet. I was hoping they'd bring down their reasons before today's talk, but unfortunately not. But the Commonwealth argued a different case. They said that when Senator Nash was invalidly elected, Holly Hughes was validly elected at that time because she wasn't disqualified. She was actually qualified. So at the time of the return of the writs, even though her name wasn't mentioned on the writ, she was validly elected. Therefore, when she took up her office of profit under the Crown, she was disqualified from sitting rather than being made incapable of being elected, that she had already been elected. Now, if that's the consequence, why is that important? It's important because it changes the way the seat is filled. It means then that you've got a casual vacancy, which means Section 15 of the Constitution applies in terms of filling the seat, rather than having a recount, which is what you would have had if she was incapable of being elected. Now, the argument is put that the reason that the Commonwealth proposed that solution was in order to get Senator Nash back into the Parliament to fill the casual vacancy. The problem, however, is that it doesn't actually work. And this all goes back to Gough Whitlam and the various shenanigans that happened in the Senate during that period and the 1977 referendum, where they entrenched in Section 15 of the Constitution the requirement that you replace the person who vacates the Senate seat with somebody of the same party. And it has to be somebody of the same party, which was the party under which the original elected person was elected at the time of the election. So if you leave your party or whatever, that doesn't count. It's whatever party you stood for and were recognised as an endorsed candidate of at the election when you were originally chosen. So if it was the case that Holly Hughes was originally chosen and then had a seat vacated because of an office of profit under the Crown, then the answer is she was an endorsed Liberal candidate and you could only fill the seat with someone from the Liberal Party. So unless Fiona Nash suddenly filled out some forms and became a member of the Liberal Party, she wouldn't be able to fill that seat. Interestingly, however, Holly Hughes would be able to fill that seat. So she could have filled the seat of her own vacancy resulting from her own disqualification, but only if the seat she had been originally validly elected and the election period wasn't elongated. Okay, but if you go back to the previous authorities of the High Court has suggested that no, what would have happened was on Fiona Nash being elected at the time she was disqualified, that would have elongated the election period until the recount has been held, in which case neither Holly Hughes nor Fiona Nash were capable of being chosen. And until the next person on the recount comes up, then the seat isn't actually filled and the election isn't over. So those of you who thought that the 2016 election was really over, no, it's not. It lives on. In fact, it currently lives on in infamy for a very long time. A further temporal problem was raised but not resolved in back to Senator Cullerton's case, or I should say Rodney Cullerton's case, as he never technically was a senator. So what happens if a disability is removed with retrospective effect so that in law the disqualifying factor actually never happened? Now, Cullerton argued that the subsequent annulment of his conviction meant that the conviction had never actually legally occurred and therefore was not disqualified. Therefore, he was not disqualified. Now, the High Court rejected that argument. They said that the particular law in that case that provided for annulment provided only for annulment to happen prospectively, not retrospectively. So it didn't actually arise in the case. So the majority of the court said, we don't need to decide that very tricky question of what happens if retrospectively the disqualifying event is by law held never to have happened. Justice Nettle, however, did deal with it. He said that Section 44(2) was directed to a conviction in fact, regardless of whether it's subsequently annulled. He considered that there was no room for contingent qualification and that the Constitution required certainty that at the date of nomination, a nominee is capable of being chosen. He concluded that an understanding of Section 44(2) as requiring order and certainty in the electoral process accords with the system of representative and responsible government established by the Constitution. Now, given the High Court's recent very strict judgment in the Ree Canavan case and its desire for certainty and stability, even though Justice Nettle was only one judge in the Cullerton case, I think it's reasonably likely that if the court did face that issue again about a law with retrospective effect getting rid of your disqualifying event, I think they would hold the same way. So if we're looking for solutions at the moment as to how to get rid of these sorts of problems, having a law which retrospectively removes whatever your disqualifying factor was is probably not going to be sufficient to get you there. A final timing problem concerns the timing of the actual removal of the disqualification. What happens if a person has, prior to nomination, taken all reasonable steps to rid himself or herself of a disqualifying disability, such as by renouncing foreign citizenship or resigning from an office of profit under the Crown or selling shares in a corporation that holds an agreement with the Commonwealth Public Service, but that process hasn't been, that action hasn't been processed in time by the other party that needs to do so to actually terminate to a disqualifying factor. A number of members of Parliament apparently took action before nomination to renounce foreign citizenship, but it was not processed in the relevant country until sometime after nomination. This meant that at the time of nomination, they actually held dual citizenship. Did that disqualify them? Were they incapable of being chosen, even though they had done everything that they could in advance of the nomination date, because they were still technically dual citizens at the time of nomination? Again, we don't know the answer for sure for this. In Ree Canavan, the High Court seemed to wish to confine the notion of what is meant by reasonable steps, so that doesn't augur well for those in that position. They said Section 44(1) is cast in peremptory terms. Where the personal circumstances of a would-be candidate give rise to disqualification under Section 44(1), the reasonableness of steps taken by way of inquiry to ascertain whether those circumstances exist is immaterial to the operation of Section 44(1). The court also said that the reasonable steps that must be taken are those required by the foreign law for renunciation of citizenship, not the steps that the relevant candidate thought were reasonable. Now, one argument is that it's not reasonable to take action shortly before the nomination date and expect it to be processed in time. This is particularly the case if a candidate has deliberately delayed taking action so that he or she can potentially withdraw their application for renunciation after election when they discover that they haven't been elected. And if that's the game that people are playing, or if the High Court gets a sniff of that, you can imagine that it wouldn't be terribly impressed. On the other hand, however, a person might have been pre-selected shortly before a by-election that's been, come up without warning, or an early election might be held, so that candidates may have only been pre-selected a short time before the election has been held. And they did not have sufficient time to be able to remove all disqualifying factors. Should a prospective candidate be held hostage to disqualification by short time frames or the amount of time that it takes for renunciation to be processed and recorded by the bureaucracy in a foreign country? Now, as you're probably aware, there have been dueling opinions about this. You've got David Bennett QC on the one hand, you've got Peter Hanks QC on the other. Which one's right? Well, I think the answer is we just cannot know until such time as the High Court decides. It's because there are two decent arguments on either side. Okay, so on the one side, there is the argument that the High Court in Ree Canavan, every time it referred to reasonable steps, it did so in the context of the notion that a person should not be irremediably prevented from being a member of parliament. So they were directed at circumstances where the other country wouldn't let you renounce, or circumstances where the other country's conditions for renunciation were unreasonable. So if they were, you actually had to go to that country and there may well then be threats to your life or person. Say you were a refugee from somewhere, you couldn't return to the country and the only way you could renounce was by being in the country physically to do it. So in those circumstances, the High Court accepted again in Ree Canavan that you could take reasonable steps to renounce and that was sufficient. What it didn't say in Ree Canavan was that where you do have a country that does allow you to take reasonable steps to renounce, you only have to do what your side of the bargain and you don't have to wait for the other side to do their side. They just didn't address that. And so on that side, you could argue, well, maybe reasonable steps taken by a person isn't enough to get you there. You actually have to have got rid of your dual citizenship before nomination. The other side of the argument, again, a reasonable argument, is that, well, the High Court in Ree Canavan did strongly support the majority findings in Sykes and Cleary. And if you go back and you look at Sykes and Cleary and the references in Ree Canavan to Sykes and Cleary, they do refer to the taking of reasonable steps in the context where the other country would allow you to renounce. So it depends very much on what you're looking for in the judgment. If you're looking for anything expressed to support that reasonable steps argument, it's just not there in Ree Canavan. But if you're looking for the implication arising from their support from Sykes and Cleary, then you can certainly pull that string out. And so each side is arguing one or the other, but you'll just not know until the High Court looks at it one way or another. But the one thing to be wary at is in all these judgments so far, the High Court has taken a very strict and literal view of the Constitution. Now, a few other things, briefly, that we've learnt from these cases. First of all, in terms of constitutional interpretation of Section 44, the High Court has, as I said, applied it very strictly and consistently done so. It said it will adhere closely to the ordinary and natural meaning of the language. It will favour stability, certainty, and the setting of a clear rule over rules that accommodate discretion or personal knowledge or subjectivity. Purpose is quite interesting. If you look at it in comparison in the various cases, if you look at the Day case and the Cullerton case, purpose played a really important role in influencing the High Court's interpretation. But if you look in Ree Canavan, purpose didn't play a very significant role. And when it did play a role, the notion of purpose was actually quite distorted in relation to that. So it's a curious thing, the High Court's not being very consistent on that point. In relation to Section 44(1), the court confirmed that whether a person has the status of a subject or a citizen of a foreign power necessarily depends upon the law of the foreign power, because only a foreign law can be the source of status or citizenship of that other country. Now, this has the unfortunate consequence that the application of a provision of the Australian Constitution is dependent upon the vagaries of foreign law. A foreign law which might be changed without notice or applied retrospectively or be unclear in its application, as was the case in relation to Italian law in its application to Senator Canavan. Now, if you talk to academics about the Ree Canavan case, the most bizarre part of the case is actually the case, the bit in relation to Senator Canavan and how he survived when the others didn't. And if you look at it, it's not very satisfactory reasoning. Which is why it's all very odd. So you might recollect what happened was that Senator Canavan had been formally registered with the Italian consulate as being an Italian citizen, Italian resident abroad, which allowed him to vote in Italian elections. The High Court distinguished that from a separate application for a declaration of citizenship and said that they're two different things, that he hadn't actually applied for citizenship. And in interpreting the evidence before the High Court, which was partly conflicting, decided that when it came to actually seeking a declaration of citizenship, you actually had to take a further step of registration. Now, the bizarre thing that comes out of it is that the court doesn't address the application of the other part of Section 44.1, the bit down the bottom that everybody keeps trying to ignore because it's just too full of horrible potentialities that nobody really wants to address it. And that's the bit where it's not just whether you're a subject or citizen of a foreign country, but it's whether you're entitled to the privileges of a subject or citizen of a foreign country. And you would have thought that of all things, being registered to vote in the country, even though you hadn't actually taken the step of registering citizenship in the country, would be precisely what that part of Section 44.1 is actually intended to do. So the strange thing about the High Court's judgment is it just doesn't address whether the fact that he was entitled to vote and was registered as being entitled to vote in Italian elections was sufficient to trigger that application of Section 44.1 of the Constitution. So we're all just left scratching our heads, wondering what on earth that last little bit of Section 44.1 is all about, because it really wasn't made clear by the High Court. If I may have the indulgence of 5 more minutes or so, I will have just have a little talk about some other aspects of Section 44 of the Constitution. So, office of profit under the Crown. So the Sykes and Cleary case was about the only proper authority we had in relation to this back in 1992. But it does raise a number of uncertainties that are still at play at the moment. One of them is local government, whether a member of local government can also be a member of the Commonwealth Parliament without that working as a disqualifying factor. There seems to have been a sort of a tacit truce between the major parties on this for a very long time. Neither side has ever taken action against the other because you'd probably knock out as many of your own people as you would on the other side. And so up until now, and indeed generally in relation to Section 44, there's been a reasonable degree of latitude given by each side to another. At the moment, though, in the current circumstances, it's every man or woman for themselves. And everybody's attacking on everything, and so you can see from that point of view that this issue may well now get ventilated. So the question is the holding of an office of a local councillor or a mayor an office of profit under the Crown? First question, is it an office of profit? Now, if you look at local government statutes, often they'll say that local councillors are paid an allowance. It's not actually supposed to be remuneration. If you look at it in substance, it's pretty much always remuneration because there's usually also a provision that says that, you know, any expenses that you have can be reimbursed as well. So it's quite clear that what you're being paid is actually remuneration of some kind. And if you look at the statutes, like in Victoria, for example, a mayor in Victoria can earn as much as $100,000. Okay, we're not talking about insignificant amounts of money. Clearly that is profit. Therefore, it is an office of profit. The question then is it an office of profit under the Crown? Okay, that's the hard bit, is it under the Crown? Now, with local government, the key thing that might save local councillors is that they are elected, because that in itself would be not under the Crown, it's not a gift of the Crown, it's a gift of the people who elect you. The difficulty, however, is that there are other factors where the Crown does have a role. So local councillors can normally be sacked by a state government. So they can be dismissed and they can be the subject of instructions as well. And so the issue of whether you're under the Crown is not just a matter of appointment, it's also a matter of removal, and it's a matter of whether you're responsible to or under a degree of control of the relevant state government. And so in those circumstances, you've got, you're safe on one, but you're vulnerable on two others. And the question is, how would a court decide that? And it depends very much, I think, on what they take as the purpose of the provision. If they just say the purpose of the provision is to prevent attempts to influence by handing out these sorts of offices, then because governments can't control who's elected or chosen as a local councillor, then you're safe. But if they say the other factor involved in the purpose of it is conflict of interest, then you're much more vulnerable because clearly you could have a significant conflict of interest if you held the role of a local councillor who's responsible for the interests, protecting the interests of your local council area, as opposed to also being a member of the Commonwealth Parliament, where your responsibility is much broader to the people of Australia or to your electorate as opposed to your particular council area. There is a potential for conflict of interest there. If that's the criteria that the High Court applies, then local councillors really will have an issue in terms of disqualification if they're elected to Parliament. And the other one there is, which is close to the heart of some of my colleagues, doesn't worry me because I don't want to be a member of Parliament, but it's being a university, being employed by a university. Is that an office of profit under the Crown? I think that one's probably safer, but it depends again on the various statutes that establish the particular university. And with both with local government and with employment in universities, it's different in every state, and it's sometimes, particularly with universities, is different according to which different university and the statute that creates it. But looking at the ANU statute, for example, in relation to Andrew Bartlett, he's probably okay because if you look at the statute, ANU established as a body corporate, separate from the government. Government has influence on the members of the council of it because they can appoint 7 members, but subject to conditions about recommendations. Employees are employed by that corporation. There are protections in relation to the integrity of the university, etc., etc., probably sufficiently independent to get you out of trouble. But again, be very helpful if the High Court would tell us some of these things. The last thing is pecuniary interest. This is the worst part of Section 44. And frankly, apart from the fact that it was really boring as well, frankly, if I had ever been sort of trying to anticipate when would we have the cascading crisis of people losing their spots because of Section 44, I would never have picked 44.1 as the culprit. 44.1 is as clear as day in comparison to 44.5. There being a very bad pun in there if you picked it up. 44.5 is much more oblique and difficult. And what we did get from the Dave case in the High Court was not a deal of clarity, but we know that it's much more expansive in its application than we'd thought. Chief Justice Barwick had tried to confine Section 44.5 to legal interests. The High Court in the Day case, no, not just legal interests, beneficial interests, family trusts, okay? All those politicians out there who have family trusts should be very worried because the next potential cascade for all of this will be, what is your family trust doing? What relationship does it have with other corporations and the like? And, you know, potentially there is a massive area of problem there. I won't go into the details, but the Allie and Gillespie case, which is going to be heard by the High Court, well, at least the preliminary stages of it are going to be heard in December, does raise difficult issues. It may give us a little bit more light on the problem, but in the end, 44.5 is the most difficult part of Section 44, and frankly, if you're going to clean up any part of Section 44, that would definitely be a candidate to make it a lot clearer because it's not clear in its current wording. I don't think it could ever be clear in its current wording. And it really does need to be addressed because it's an absolute minefield. And I note that yesterday this issue was referred to the JCS, Joint Committees, Joint Standing, JSCEM, to deal with, and that's probably a very good idea. Okay, so in conclusion, there's a lot we still don't know about the intricacies of the application of Section 44 of the Constitution. Nonetheless, nearly all the problems can be avoided candidates simply being very prudent. If you were advising someone who wanted to be a candidate for Parliament, then just say, look, when in doubt, renounce. Okay, get rid of your offices of profit, don't have contracts with anyone in relation to anything, and you will be okay. Ultimately, the answer here is prudence. Just be very, very, very prudent and cautious, and then you will be okay. In terms of other options, you know, is legislation going to get you very far? Probably not. The High Court has said, you know, things like overseas citizenship is determined by foreign law. Australian law can't change that. Okay, so legislation's probably not going to be terribly helpful. Changing the constitution, yes, if you're going to do it, fix up the whole of Section 44, not just part of it. Given the conflicting priorities that are in play at the moment in relation to other issues where people want dealt with by referendum, I think you're going to have real difficulties in getting the Australian people wanting to deal with Section 44 when frequently they see this as a problem of the politician's own making and not something for them, which needs to be addressed for them. So I think there are real difficulties in going ahead with that. So my message in the end is that prudence and vigilance by candidates and parties is the best means of preventing disqualification crises from arising in the future. Thank you.
Thanks, Anne. I think my brain's full. Does anyone have any questions, Kim?
Okay. So far, people have been disqualified under the letter of Section 44.1. The technical Australian term, I think, is the by. Surely, some things have been reported in the news recently. It's more about when I start passing on, Sam does the argument seriously. Surely that's is under any acknowledgement or allegiance, obedience or adherence to a foreign power. He surely must be towing that line.
That brings me to something that, you know, I cut out a fair bit there, and there is going to be a proper paper that will be put on the parliamentary website. So one of the things that strikes me about all of this is if you're going to reform Section 44 of the Constitution, it would really help to try and make the words in Section 44 match what you describe as the vibe, the purpose. And you're quite right. The irony about Section 44.1 is that all of the people who've been knocked off in relation to it, no one has ever seriously thought that what they did in any way compromised Australia's national or international interests. So it didn't meet the vibe or indeed the purpose. And that's why I said the High Court took quite a strangled sort of purpose from Section 44.1. What they did was that they split Section 44.1 into two parts. They said the first part is about you positively doing something, so that's acknowledging allegiance to a foreign power, etc. So purpose and knowledge, etc., all work in there. And then they said, but the second bit just says, has the status of being you are a subject or a citizen. And that's just a matter of fact, and you don't need to have knowledge for that. And so when they tried to tie that to purpose, they then said, well, the purpose involved there is that simply because you have that status as a citizen of a foreign country, you have attached to that legal obligations. And those legal obligations have the potential to undermine your single-minded support for Australia. That's a bizarre sort of analysis. Really, if you're coming back to the reality of this, one of the problems in it seems to be simply moving from the active to the passive voice. I mean, if you're an English teacher, this would be a great example of the problems that can occur when you move from one thing where you're actively involved to another thing that just refers to sort of status. Apart from the grammatical problems in it, there are real problems, as you say, with Section 44.1 and whether the words actually match the purpose behind it and whether the High Court was properly applying purpose in these circumstances. My gut feeling is that they sort of, moved away from purpose in order to actually give certainty a test because they didn't like the idea of a test that involved subjectivity of personal knowledge, and they just didn't want to get into that. They didn't think it was a legally accessible standard, and so they tried to move away from it. I don't think it's something that we can deal with at this stage unless you actually change Section 44 and try and match up and ask yourself, well, what is the purpose of these disqualification provisions? What are we trying to achieve with them? And if you did that, these days, the problem wouldn't be whether you're a citizen of a foreign country. The problem would be things like whether you're accepting donations from, political donations from foreign countries or interests of foreign countries and those sorts of things. So, you know, where does real foreign influence, insidious influence lie? It lies in political donations. It lies in funding of politicians to take trips to various countries to do study tours to learn about, you know, all that sort of business. That's where the insidious influence lies. And so if you're going to have a proper provision that was intended to protect the Australian Parliament and the Australian people by making sure that members of Parliament do have solely the interests of their country in their mind, I think you'd be changing it in a different way. So that you dealt with those sort of issues rather than simply formalities of citizenship.
One of the issues in relation to the Senate in particular is that when you have someone who acknowledges that they're subject to a Section 44 disqualification in the House, they can resign and trigger a by-election.
Yep.
But there's no provisions anywhere for ordering a recount other than the Court of Disputed Returns declaring so. And so as a result, we have all these cases that pop up in the Senate, and for some reason most of them are in the Senate. And for former senators who are disqualified, who essentially plead no contest, like Senator Parry, for example, they still have to be referred, which requires a sitting of Parliament and requires a sitting of the High Court. Would it be constitutional to write something into the Electoral Act that allowed, for example, the Senate or the President of the Senate to order a recount, do essentially what the High Court would have done without needing to bother the High Court about it?
Yeah, I think you probably could do that. Off the top of my head, now I might need to think about it some more, but off the top of my head, I think you probably could. There certainly is room for procedural change because a lot of this stuff in terms of the High Court's jurisdiction is there simply because it's there in the Electoral Act, and the Electoral Act can be changed. And I think that sort of thing would be fine. I think where people would have concerns, and where I would have concerns, because this idea has been floating out there, is where you try and just change the electoral legislation simply to prevent these issues ever going to the High Court so that you just acknowledge that you have all these people who are disqualified happily sitting and voting in Parliament, but no one can do anything about it. If you were doing that sort of thing, I think people would be exceedingly angry and disturbed by it. But if it's simply a matter of facilitating the filling of the seat by the ordinary process of recount in the Senate, then I can't see why there'd be a problem with doing that. Having said that, in terms of bothering the High Court, I mean, I think that, you know, procedurally it's not particularly difficult. Of all the things that they have to deal with and get bothered by, I suspect that's not one of the more significant burdens that they carry.
Thank you. Paul, Boris Japance. Harriet, and then 1, 2, 3. So Harriet first.
I was just thinking on what you were saying about local councillors. This may be a very stupid question, but I'm trying to think it through. If the High Court was to say that a local councillor was out because they were effectively remunerated and could be sacked by the state government, therefore that was an officer under the Crown, then would not the same reasoning apply to the Prime Minister who can be sacked?
Well, the one thing is that in Section 44 there is an express exception in there for the appointment of ministers. So ministers do hold offices for profit under the Crown, but they're expressly excluded from the application of Section 44 of the Constitution. So people don't say that too often, but it's in the extra bit down the bottom after you get through with the relevant paragraphs. So that avoids that problem.
And yes.
My question is actually to do with Section 15.
Yep.
If there is a requirement that a senator who resigns is replaced by the state parliament, by a senator from the same party.
Yep.
What happens in the situation where a senator has become an independent, and while they're sitting in the Senate, the party that they were initially elected from dissolves and no longer exists?
Yeah, there is, I'd have to go back and check the words of Section 15, but there is some recognition that if the party no longer exists or there is no person of that party who could take the position, then I think it just leaves it to the you know, state parliament to work out who to put in those circumstances. So they did think about that beforehand, but the key thing to it was to prevent people who had defected from one party and then joined another party, then using that second party as being the basis for filling their vacancy. It's only whatever party you were elected under, but if that party doesn't exist and there's no one left, then in those circumstances, there has to be some flexibility involved.
And Phil, and then...
And this may be a comment rather than a question, but I agree with you about politicians being prudent. That's an excellent path to take. And there is also the perception, as you say, that if something were to attempt to be done about Section 3 Court, it might be seen as something being done for politicians, which will be unattractive and unpopular. But at the same time, aren't we left in a situation where we have a constitution that now is sort of actively discriminatory against the 25% of people born overseas or 50% of people with parents born overseas? Isn't there like whole categories of people who are now sort of have a higher bar almost if they want to be elected to Parliament? And I guess my concern is that anyone who runs for office is sort of a politician, but there's a lot of perhaps talent out there who now have a higher bar than people, say, born here.
Yeah, well, but that's the case for... Well, first of all, it's also for the case of people born here, so as Barnaby Joyce and other people found out, being born here is not necessarily going to get you out of these problems. But it also applies in relation to the other provisions there too. Interestingly, when I was teaching this a class about this, because this year we actually did a whole two-hour lecture on disqualifications thing, seemed to be the issue du jour, one of my students became very agitated and said about the bankruptcy provision. He said, but that's just discriminatory against people who are, you know, involved in business, and it discriminates against capitalism, and it's a socialist provision, he said. Well, this is quite interesting for a university student, but anyway. It discriminates against the bankrupt, but it also discriminates against, you know, potentially people like me, people who work in a university. It certainly discriminates against anyone who works in the public sector, because if you have to give up your job, you know, it's a big deal. In fact, I'd say that's a bigger deal than having to give up a foreign citizenship, you know, that you don't necessarily need to rely on. In relation to any of these people who got caught out in relation to the citizenship thing, were any of them not wanting to renounce, you know, were any of them doing it because they desperately wanted to keep their citizenship? I think the answer in relation to probably all of them was no. So the problem wasn't the fact that they needed to renounce. The problem was just that they hadn't realised that they needed to renounce. So is it actively discriminatory against people by putting up a higher bar? Well, yes, it is a higher bar, and for some people it will actually cost a fair bit of money to get legal advice or whatever to deal with it. That's true. But in terms of, you know, cost, if you have to give up a position in the public sector, that's going to be a bigger cost before you run for Parliament. There are costs we all pay, and, you know, maybe that's just one of them.
Question here in the front, and then
I'm sort of just going off on a bit of the side. In relation to ministers that are found to be ineligible, there's been a bit of confusion, I think, in the media and a little bit in the academic circles about what happens to decisions that they make when they are found to be ineligible and how long that lasts. And in my section, which is actually the old section you used to work in legal con, we were having a discussion about, well, where does that timeline actually apply? Mm. So does it go all the way back to when they were first elected, which for Mr. Joyce...
That's a long time.
A long time ago. But, or would it be the most recent election? Or was it when he became a minister?
Yeah. Well, the first answer is nobody knows, because there's just no authority on this, so you can't give an authoritative answer at all. Second, that sort of, you know, the de facto officer doctrine, you know, we assume it will apply to protect decisions, in which case it would apply all the way back to the beginning of when they were a minister, and will continue to apply up until possibly the point at which there was sufficient doubt about whether they were validly a minister because they'd referred themselves to the High Court. So my argument was, at least from that point on, those decisions are more vulnerable, because the whole idea of the de facto officer doctrine is that everybody, including yourself, believed you validly held that position and therefore people relied on it. But could you say that from the point at which the person said, "Oh, I don't think I'm validly a member of parliament, I need the High Court to decide"? Well, from that point on, that cloak of the de facto officer doctrine sort of is potentially whipped away. So that's the more vulnerable period. But yeah, technically, any ministerial decision made all the way back to wherever they started as a minister would be vulnerable if the de facto officer doctrine didn't apply. Now, if you look at authority in relation to this, there's a little bit, there was a suggestion, at least a couple of cases, that maybe the de facto officer doctrine doesn't apply where it's a constitutional issue. But I don't think the High Court would do that, because the chaos that could potentially ensue from having ministerial decisions going back many, many years being potentially challenged would be so great. And because, and remember, this doctrine is not there to protect the minister or the officer involved, it's there to protect the people who rely on the decision. Because there's been so much reliance on those past decisions, I just can't see a court doing that. So from my point of view, I think de facto officer doctrine will probably work at least up until the point at which they were referred to the High Court, and that any vulnerability would only happen in that short period from when they were referred until when they were actually held to be not a minister. I think that's the vulnerable period.
I think we only have time for one more.
In the case of senators who are elected at a half-senate election, there can be a period of up to 12 months before they take their seat. Are they covered by the Office of Profit Provisions in the intervening period?
Yeah, so I think that was the Jeannie Ferris case, wasn't it? She took up a... she was had a staffer position or something in the meantime, and then that caused... Got that right? Yes. Anyway, sorry, there's some nodding or discussion over there. I haven't looked at that one for a long time, but certainly at least there was one person who did get caught in relation to that. So you have to be careful in that period as well, not to have an office of profit under the Crown, because it can make you incapable of being... Oh, sorry, then it would make you unable. You would have been validly elected, you would have been validly chosen, but then you would disqualify yourself from being able to sit. So then it would lead to a casual vacancy. And I think she ended up filling her own casual vacancy.
In the case that somebody's elected in August, they don't take their seat till the 1st of July.
Yeah, you? They've got to find a job in the private sector. They can't work for a politician or in the public sector in that period. Yeah.
Sorry, John, can I just ask a directly related follow-up question to that?
Supplementary, yeah.
Yes. So given what we currently know about the High Court's interpretation of Section 44... could Jeannie Ferris have done that?
Sorry?
Resigned and filled her own casual vacancy.
I think she did.
She did.
She did, yeah. But under our current... under what we... what the
yeah, no, so long as she was validly chosen, so she didn't hold that position from nomination to the date of return of the writs, and so she was validly chosen, if she then went and got an office of profit under the Crown, she would be then... it would be a disqualification from sitting, which would be a casual vacancy because she was validly chosen. Therefore, she could fill the casual vacancy. Technically, you could do it, earn your salary, cause your own casual vacancy and then fill it. But I don't think your party would think very much of it if you have a sort of a method of earning money in the meantime. So maybe not the best of ideas.
I think we do. We're a couple of minutes shy. We've got time for one last one. Rob.
The Parliament raised a scenario where a senator is declared ineligible, they do a recount, and the next person who's to be elected has meanwhile changed parties, maybe gone from Liberal to One Nation or even to Labour. Would the High Court think about the principles of Section 15 casual vacancy in that case?
Yeah, no, I have been asked that because it is a an issue in play. And I think in the end, the Constitution doesn't care what party you belong to in relation to, you know, it only cares what party you belong to in relation to a Section 15 casual vacancy, and only because of those 1977 amendments. Otherwise, the Constitution is colourblind when it comes to party. So if you were elected under the auspices, you know, at the time of the poll, if you were under the colour of one political party and then you bailed out shortly thereafter, which, by the way, does sometimes happen, as we've recently noted, it doesn't really matter because the people still chose you. It's because you were chosen by the people. It's not because of the party that you belong to. So the answer is it wouldn't make any difference. You'd still be chosen even if you had bailed out on the party. I mean, you might be regarded as a rat by the people of the party that you bailed out of, but nonetheless, you would still be chosen because the people still voted for you, technically.
Ladies and gentlemen, I think we're out of time. A tremendous return to a former researcher here in the library. Thank you very much for travelling to Sydney to discuss the complexities, ins and outs of the Pandora's box that is Section 44. Please join me in thanking Anthony. And of course, if there's any, as you will have noticed, it's being recorded by our colleagues in broadcasting, so if you need to watch the whole thing again to try and get it straight on your head, you can, or you can share it with friends. But thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you.